Hi, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight by everyone's favorite host. Literally everyone's favorite. JB, how are you, sir?
I'm JB of the future, and you don't understand. We don't have podcasts like this in the future. You're not appreciative enough, and the air doesn't have this smell. This air smells so good.
12 Monkeys.
We're talking about 12 monkeys tonight.
If, in not case the movie.
No.
12 different actual monkeys. Simians.
Monkey number one.
Patrick seems to be talking about 12 movies about monkeys. I'm talking about the 12 actual chimps that moved into my house. So, monkey number one, fastidious. Monkey number two, stuck up. That's all I got.
He's an a-hole monkey. Once again, you're listening to F This Movie, which you can find online at fthismovie.blogspot.com. On Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie, on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie, at DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com, and you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com in case there are things about the show that you wish were different and you would like to point them out to us, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Letters. We get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters. Plus, responding to a recent email, just to make things clear, Patrick and I are in love.
That's right.
I'm tired of hiding it. He's my schmoopy. He's my tall little boy. And I'm his Papa Bear.
JB, have you seen anything good lately? Besides these eyes.
At this point, that 60s song starts to play softly in the background. These eyes. That was... Okay.
Michael Cera does a killer rendition of that in Superbad. There's a room full of, like, drug dealers. He's at that party that
gets
really scary.
No, I've seen the movie.
Yeah. I'm just recreating the scene.
I don't remember that scene.
They, like, force him to sing, and that's the song he does.
A fine choice.
Yeah.
Of late, I've been seeing documentaries. Mm. I saw a documentary that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Not great. It's worth everyone's time. It's called Palm Wonderful Presents the Greatest Movie Ever Sold. Which I was happy got out to the suburbs because Spurlock's last film did not.
No, and with good reason, I would argue.
And I'd really hate to think that Mr. Spurlock is a one-trick pony because I enjoyed Supersize Me. Although, as time goes on, that film's reputation is getting tarnished.
Yeah.
Because the general critical consensus now, which is what, like 10 years?
Maybe not even, but yeah, close. Probably close.
A couple years on has been, so... You ate McDonald's for a whole month and you got fat, huh? That's real good.
Well, but the movie, I think, has more to say than just that.
In Supersize Me, I was impressed by the way he presented a lot of information in a really, really both easy-to-understand way and in a very entertaining way. There are volumes of data in that film that he wrangles. The new film is entertaining. I kept wanting it to be better. There are moments when it looks like it's going somewhere interesting, but...
The thesis of the movie is what? There's a lot of product placement in movies, right?
Yes. And clearly his researchers come up with some really great things. I mean, I think the highlight of the film was a snippet from a Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial, which I don't remember seeing. My guess is it didn't run for very long, because... Anyone seeing it, either back then or now, would say, what? The typical commercial where the wife is initiating something in the kitchen and the husband has to go along. You and Erica have talked about this.
Yes.
The stereotypical,
right.
Frightening married couple relationship.
Right.
The wife boldly declares that that's it. They're going to eat healthy from now on. And she produces a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Mm.
And the commercial is only from about 10 years ago. So it's like, what universe did anyone think? It's like...
This was when they still had the word fried in their name, right? Because now they're KFC.
I don't remember which era it's from, but I think the film needed more of that. And the interesting thing is he offers the product placements in the film in exchange for money to make the film. And what I thought was one of the more interesting points that is never pounded home in an obnoxious way... It seems clear that Palm Wonderful exerted the most control because they gave the most money. They had their name above the title. And in the middle of the movie, there's a Palm Wonderful commercial that he produced.
Okay.
That's awful. because earlier we see them with their fingers in every pie and they won't let him do anything that he wants to do. And it comes across as, oh, the movie stops dead in its track for this commercial because Palm Wonderful gave him some money. The Hyatt people, on the other hand, and let me tell you, I love Hyatt Hotels, give him free reign. And the commercial he comes up with for them is so funny.
Oh, wow.
And makes you want to stay there. But it's crazy.
Right.
But I thought that was interesting. On a much better note, this would have been yesterday. Good Lord. I finally saw Cave of Forgotten Dreams by Werner Herzog. And that film is sublime. I mean, there's a reason why it's got this insane rating on the tomato meter.
Oh, and right.
Everyone who's seeing it loves it. It's about the oldest known cave paintings in France. Hold on. I know that doesn't sound like the most interesting thing. But again, remember, this is Werner Herzog, the man who hauled a steamship up a mountain. And he made it, and he narrates it, and it is fascinating. I liken it to the early films of Errol Morris that invite us to think. It's an invitation to meditate on this very, very weighty subject, and it's very profound. It's also in 3D because he wanted to accurately show the topography of the caves because they're not flat, and it seems that early man used that in their construction of these pictures. And, of course, the pictures in question are 32,000 years old. And it's just fascinating, and I recommend it. And stick with it, because at the end, there's something that's so insane. It could only come from the director of Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
I want to see it just based on that. But it's, I have no use for 3D. But when directors that I like and respect use it, you sort of get your hopes up that, oh, they're going to use it in an interesting way. Somebody like Herzog, I would see a movie in 3D, or, you know, Scorsese's going to do a movie in 3D. I'm sort of interested in what he does. But for the most, you know, when Rob Marshall does it for Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
And no, thank you.
Certainly in the Herzog film, nothing is thrown at you, but
right.
He uses it in an interesting way. And,
do you think Grizzly Man should have been in 3D?
Only the last 10 minutes.
Oh. I saw a documentary as well. That's really the only thing I can bring up. And it is a documentary from a couple years ago called Zombie Girl, the Movie. And it is about a 12-year-old girl named Emily Higgins, who lives in Austin, Texas, and is a frequent patron of the Alamo Draft House. She starts going there a lot with her mom, especially to see the Lord of the Rings movies. And she would have been under 10 years old when those were out. And the guy who owns the Alamo notices that she's coming back over and over again to see Lord of the Rings 5, 6, 7 times. And so he throws her name out to Harry Knowles, who every year for his birthday does a 24-hour film festival.
Is that the Butt-Numathon?
So this girl writes a letter to Peter Jackson. Peter Jackson writes her back. And Harry Knowles, I believe, is premiering Return of the King at his Butt-Numathon. So he invites this girl, Emily, to come see it. He invites her to the festival. And he expects that she's going to come out all freaked out about Return of the King and in love with it. And apparently at that same Butt-Numathon, he screened an Australian zombie movie called Undead by the Spierig brothers, who went on to make Daybreakers. And apparently that's the movie that really caught her fancy, and she came out of it wanting to make a zombie movie. So at 12 years old, she writes and directs this zombie movie called Pathogen. And the documentary is just about the production of that movie. And on the surface, it's very much just, let's follow a 12-year-old girl as she makes a movie. But it's about a lot more than that. It's about the relationship that she has with her mom, who is extremely supportive, even though she doesn't necessarily, it's not really her interest, but she really throws herself into it. And it's about just making an independent film. It's interesting because it's all kids, you know, basically that are acting in the movie, that are making the movie. But at the same time, all of the things that you see that go wrong, all of the obstacles that she faces, are the exact same obstacles that every independent filmmaker comes up against. Just, we don't have enough extras in this shot. We're running out of time. This effect doesn't look the way I want it to. It's very entertaining and it's interesting. And it's out on DVD. I saw it on Netflix Instant. So you can watch it there. Zombie Girl, the movie. She has gone on to direct, I think, two or three other movies, including her most recent was called My Sucky Teen Romance, of course, about two teenagers in love, one of whom is a vampire. I wonder where she got that idea.
That sounds very interesting. It sounds like something that I would really, really like.
Yeah, it's good. Let's talk 12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys.
1, 2, 3, 4. I can't count that high. 12 Monkeys, directed by Terry Gilliam from 1995. I have to admit that I am a fan. Well, I'm a fan of 12 Monkeys. And let me say up front, I think it's safe to say we're going to be spoiling large elements of 12 Monkeys because I don't think it's possible to talk about sort of the big picture of that movie without spoiling certain elements.
Yes.
Because it's a movie that sort of exists in a loop, and you can't talk about it without talking about the end of the loop, I think.
Or what you might think is the end of the
loop. Well, right.
Because when I rewatched it for the podcast, certain things began to suggest themselves to me. Certain things suggested to me by my lovely wife, who kept bringing something up that I had never considered, because I can still remember very vividly the first time I saw this film.
Mm-hmm.
And how much I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And watching it again for the podcast, and I don't mean to sound like Grandpa, this film gives you so much credit for being on the ball, for being able to keep more than one ball in the air, sorry to mix the metaphor, to pay attention and pick up on subtle clues. It is not pandering to you
mm-hmm.
in the way it presents itself.
Okay.
But that being said, the first time I saw it, I thought this was a movie about someone from the future,
where future events, such as these, will affect us all. For that is where you and I will be spending the rest of our lives.
Can you prove it didn't happen? At this point, the podcast takes a left turn, and we just wind up swapping lines from Plan 9 for the rest of the night. This individual from the future is in a very odd, very dystopian future, and he's sent back to do reconnaissance so that this problem can be solved. And I always assume that was the reality of the film. He is in the future, he's sent back, he's sent back more than once, because the things that he's saying sound like the ravings of a paranoid schizophrenic. He is often institutionalized, but that he is right in that he was sent from the future. But there's a case to be made that the past that's being presented in the film, 1990 and 1996 specifically, is the reality of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that the future is his imagining.
That, I think, becomes more suggested later on in the film where the two realities, in quotes, start to sort of combine and he's seeing people from the future in his present reality, sort of, and interacting with them.
Right, and from the first time I saw it, I never doubted Bruce Willis is being sent back to the past, that his reality in the future is the reality, and that he's not crazy.
The case that I would make against that, and there's certainly a case to be made, again, I've already warned you that there are massive spoilers for 12 Monkeys coming up, but if you haven't seen it, you should. It's great. It's Terry Gilliam. He is killed at the end of the movie. He's out of the movie, and yet the movie goes on for that scene on the airplane with David Morse and the woman from the future. Whose fantasy is that if Bruce Willis is already dead?
That it's just part of his dream.
Okay.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Because, again, watching that scene at the end, that oh-so-important scene,
mm-hmm.
I thought, and I don't know if I thought this because my wife might have brought this up. Big kudos to my lovely wife. She's very, very smart.
Hey, easy on the compliments to your wife, okay? What do you want to turn this into?
But you're talking about Schmoopy, my Schmoopy Schmoops, my lover. Oh, my lovely wife, I love you. I worship at the altar of your greatness. That we get on the plane at the end, and there's a character there that we recognize from the past.
Right.
And she casually says that she's in insurance.
Right.
Now, the Tragically Hip audience says, ah, see, they identified it, they sent her back, she's going to take care of everything. But couldn't another interpretation be?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. She's in insurance.
The reason why they're such bad... They're not really good at this technology. Right. They keep sending him back to the wrong place. My God, he winds up in World War I.
Yeah.
Is that she's not a scientist.
Right.
That in the past she was in insurance, and this is just a tip of the hat. I think if you examine the film far more closely than I really wanted to, not that it doesn't reward that sort of discussion, I think the filmmakers mean for us to accept the reality that they're presented.
I think so too, and I always have, but I like a movie, we've talked about this before even with Inception, I like a movie that allows for different readings that I think the film can support, even though I'm taking the movie at face value.
Right, and it certainly adds to the whole way that everyone responds to Bruce Willis, and that if you put yourself in the reality of the people around him, what he's saying is truly the ravings of someone that he's got this messiah complex and he's going to save the world and he's gathering information and something's controlling everyone. That being said, I thought it was really interesting that, again, the film gives us so much credit that watching it again, there's an element to this film that I think goes unexplained, that I can't wrap my head around, although the film offers several explanations. There's a voice right. that talks to Bruce Willis.
Calling him Bob. That guy.
Calling him Bob in a rough voice. And
it's always coming from a different person.
And sometimes it's just right. in his head.
Right.
Which makes you think they implanted something in his head, which leads, I think, later on. I'll spoil it later on. But there's a line in this movie I think is one of the most terrific lines ever. That we think somehow it's the voice of that other guy that they sent back who winds up being a homeless person. But later when Madeline Stowe talks to him, it's sort of clear that it's not him. So has Gilliam and his screenwriters, David Peebles, by the way, who also wrote Blade Runner, and this film was often compared to Blade Runner when it came out.
Really?
Which I think is interesting, because in the first 10 or 15 minutes, when he's first sent back, there's a shot where he's in an abandoned building, and he looks up, and there's some... It's a very beautiful shot. It calls attention to... There's all these birds fluttering up to this broken skylight. And my God, does that shot remind one of Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Also, this film opens with... green computer letters on the screen explaining things to us.
Much like
Blade Runner. So that's a trope that people likes. His last name ends in an S. That that throws all agreement issues under the bus. That I give the film so much credit for having this element that's truly odd.
Mm-hmm.
And unless I miss something, is never fully explained.
Not that I'm aware of, yeah.
Is it the scientist talking to him? Are we supposed to accept the reality that the film presents, but then there's this extra gloss that, well, Bruce has this voice in his head.
Right.
But the fact that the voice calls him Bob almost can be used as evidence that that alternate interpretation I offered...
That he is
that there
crazy.
That there might be something to it, and that right. he's someone named Bob in the present dreaming all this.
Right. And which may be, you know, the reason that that little device exists, just Terry Gilliam throwing a red herring in there. Maybe he is crazy, you know. While we've ruled out, no, he's not, because we're on his side saying he's right. Every once in a while he throws us this little indication that, no, maybe he is nuts, as you suggested.
So the entire last 10 minutes, folks, I'm going to take a big left turn now, was designed to attempt you into seeing the film. Because I have the weird feeling that if you've never seen 12 Monkeys, everything we just said will make absolutely no sense whatsoever.
True.
The film is so fresh in our minds.
Yes.
That we're talking about it like an inside joke.
Right.
That unless 12 Monkeys is fresh in your head, you might not get. On a completely different note, as I was watching it, I began to crave Mr. Bromley's opinion about something.
Okay.
Brad Pitt's performance.
Okay.
You cannot discuss this film without talking about Brad Pitt's performance. And as the film went on, I kept thinking, what does Bromley think of this these days?
Okay. Funny you should mention that, because that is one of the things I wanted to talk about. I'm of two minds on the Brad Pitt performance.
As is his character in the film.
Right. On the one hand, I applaud it because it's willing to go really wacky and out there. And if nothing else, this was the movie that demonstrated, I think, to a lot of people in Hollywood, what we have said before, and I don't believe originates with us, is that Brad Pitt is a fantastic character actor.
Yes.
Who happens to look like a leading man. And when you watch his movies where he's sort of the leading man, be it Legends of the Fall or Interview with the Vampire or Meet Joe Black or 7 Years in Tibet, it's dull. He's just dead on screen. But if you watch movies where he's doing sort of a character performance, like 12 Monkeys or Inglourious Basterds, which I love.
Or even the Ocean's films,
mm-hmm.
where he's not... That character he's come up with is clever and funny
right.
in different ways.
Or Burn After Reading.
And that's exactly what I wrote on this little sheet of paper in front of me. Ladies and gentlemen of America, Brad Pitt is not a leading man.
Mm-hmm.
He's a character actor. And
right.
he's a great character actor. Why won't we let him do that?
And we have certainly more so since 12 Monkeys. I think his performance in 12 Monkeys was at the time, and perhaps continues to be, overly praised. He won a Golden Globe for it. He was nominated for an Oscar for it. And people, that's one of the things that people really point out. Now, I have to give it credit because he's one of the things that stands out to people so much about the movie, but he's not in that much.
No.
So he really makes an impression. At the same time, I find it to be a series of mannered gesticulating
yes.
and just crazy throwing his hands around. And actually watching it this time, he does that all the time with his hands. What he does in 12 Monkeys, he has incorporated into the rest of his career. He's dialed it down, and so it's not a crazy person doing it. But all that business he does with his hands, he does in all of his movies. So I think it's a little overly praised because I really do think it's just a series of sort of tics. But if nothing else, like I said, I'm glad that it sort of broke him out of the path that he perhaps was going down. And so I think it's an important performance because I like Brad Pitt as an actor given the right movie. And so I'm happy that 12 Monkeys put him down that path, but it's not my favorite of his performances.
It's interesting because I was reading today that the makers of 12 Monkeys got him at a bargain, the last bargain anyone would ever get, because at the time his first big movies hadn't been released. And during the production of 12 Monkeys and after the production of 12 Monkeys, Thelma and Louise, River Runs Through It, and Seven were released. And I can still remember how the advertising materials for 12 Monkeys really played up that Brad Pitt was in it. And I thought they might run into the same problem that Gilliam said he found when they were advertising sneak previews of Adventures of Baron Munchausen
mm-hmm.
as featuring Sting. And Sting's
right.
in it for about 30 seconds.
Right.
And the brevity of his performance is part of the joke.
Right.
But on the voluminous supplementary materials that originally came with the Criterion Collection's Laserdisc of Munchausen, Gilliam recalls the hundreds of comment cards at the sneak preview. Where's Sting? I remembered Brad Pitt's performance in 12 Monkeys with affection
mm-hmm.
and wondered what would be my reaction to it 10 or 15 years later. I still like it a lot.
Yeah.
I really do. I will acknowledge that it's way over the top.
Right.
And I think what I like about it even more, and this goes back to my central thesis that the filmmakers are giving us a lot of credit, is that he's a very elaborate red herring, as it
mm-hmm.
turns out to be.
Right.
And beyond that, which is clever enough, I mean, the idea that a science fiction film can do some things well that are usually reserved for a mystery or something, that... It is suggested at one point that not only is Brad Pitt a red herring in terms of this plague that's been released, but as it turns out, he's responsible for all the animals that we see all over Philadelphia, and that he might have originally gotten the idea.
Right.
When Bruce Willis lands in 1990, Willis is trying to figure out, what's this with the 12 monkeys? What's this with the 12 monkeys? And must have been raving while on Thorazine, because later in the film, Brad Pitt says, you told me.
Right.
You told me about that. So this whole idea that you can go back and actually cause the thing that you're trying to prevent.
Which is so much of what the movie is sort of about. I mean, again, when you get to that loop in the airport at the end. And I will say that I like Brad Pitt's performance, if only because I think it's the biggest indication in the movie that 12 Monkeys, while perhaps not seemingly on the surface, but like every Terry Gilliam movie, is sort of this absurdist comedy. And Brad Pitt's performance is the big indication that that's the case.
That every Terry Gilliam film is an absurdist comedy with a very clear line running through mm-hmm. of what his concerns are as an artist about where we're going as a society mm-hmm. and what's wrong with that. I didn't want the podcast to end without pointing out that a week or two ago, Patrick posted a review of Pirates of the Caribbean 4, which I thought was really good, and I think you nailed it and prevented me from wasting 3 hours of my life and some of my hard-earned money. But at one point, you pointed out that the first three were done by Gore Verbinski, and that might be one of the reasons why the first one is so good, and the other ones are at least okay or whatever, but you specifically pointed out that the look of the films seemed to owe something to Gillian, and I had never thought about that before, and I've never seen that written anywhere. And the more you think about it, especially the first two, imagine a Pirates of the Caribbean film directed by Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Then you'd have something.
Yeah.
I mean, he took elderly people in an office in the Crimson Permanent Assurance at the beginning of Monty Python's The Meaning of Life and turned it into this really interesting pirate film.
And the tragedy, of course, of Terry Gilliam is that he will never have an opportunity to make a big budget studio film again, you know.
And you know what I think has something to do with that? And I think it speaks to 12 Monkeys, and it also speaks to a couple other Gilliam films. His films are so well made, they're so dense. This is a cliche, but I really think it applies to him. You cannot take it in one screening.
Yeah.
Gilliam's films, especially the really, really good ones, reward multiple screenings. I remember when Fear and Loathing came out.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that book was a very major part of my college days. And I read it over and over and over. My God, I was into Hunter S. Thompson. And I couldn't wrap my head around Gilliam's vision. So the first time I saw that film, I didn't like it very much. And with each successive viewing, I'm just more...
And I'm the same way, but having not read the book, but seeing it the first time, I was like, there's not a movie here. I don't know what this is. You know, I sort of rejected it. And the more I see it, the more I come to appreciate it.
That he's capturing something on film. And ironically, I think it's what Thompson was talking about. Ultimately, he's capturing a mood and a tone on film that's very, very hard mm-hmm. to capture, this dissolute emptiness of America in the 70s, being a hip drug addict, you know, whatever you want to say. And again, the look of that film alone, why I couldn't appreciate it the first time I saw it. But another interesting thing to talk about in terms of 12 Monkeys. Bruce Willis.
Yes.
And how much we like him.
Yeah.
And what interesting choices of roles he sometimes has. I really think that.
I do too. And he is one of these guys who's great at being a movie star, but that every once in a while is sort of willing to go out on a limb and do something that we don't expect, and do something that really helps out a movie like 12 Monkeys that maybe doesn't even exist without Bruce Willis participating. And at this point, he had already sort of had some indie credibility because he had done Pulp Fiction and he had done some of these smaller parts. Thinking back on 12 Monkeys before I rewatched it for the podcast, my concern was, I don't mean to interrupt, but Bruce Willis, unfortunately, in later years, and I still like Bruce Willis because I have a pulse and he was in Die Hard, has unfortunately sort of gone the way of like Harrison Ford and Mel Gibson, who earlier in their careers always seemed to be having fun on screen and they were cool for guys to like and women liked them because they were very handsome or charming or whatever. And in later years, they just are sort of these staid grouches on screen. And Bruce Willis, unfortunately, in recent years, has given a long line of just sort of dour, mopey performances. And that was my recollection of his performance in 12 Monkeys. I was like, I think that was the beginning of the very grim, serious Bruce Willis. And then I rewatched it, and it's not that at all. Right. It's not. He's really good in the movie. So apparently that didn't happen until later.
I agree 100% about the mopey grouch. And it's unfortunate. But my feeling is that because most people know Bruce Willis through the Die Hard movies and other things like that, that his more adventuresome roles are ignored because not enough people have seen the films. Mm-hmm. And the two that I'm thinking, just to pull two out of the hat, is he has a supporting performance in Nobody's Fool.
Yes.
The Paul Newman film.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really good.
Yeah.
Playing a bastard.
Right.
That he really never got to play in the more action-oriented films. And in one of the worst films ever made, he gives a really interesting performance. Alan Rudolph's Breakfast of Champions.
Oh, which I've never seen.
He plays Dwayne Hoover, the car salesman who goes crazy.
I remember him on the poster. He advertised the movie.
He's the only thing that is salvageable in that movie, and it's interesting because the release of that film screamed studio contract, this must open on at least two screens in the continental United States, because I happen to be in Normal, Illinois for a conference. And they opened it at this little tiny campus theater. This was its opening. It had never been shown anywhere else before.
That's pretty cool.
And I think their thinking was, oh, it's a college town. Right. You know, Vonnegut, right. It's a college town. But I sat in the theater alone.
Wow.
On opening night.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Nick Nolte is in that film.
Right.
As another car salesman. And I also discovered today that Gilliam's first vision for the leads in 12 Monkeys. I saw this too. Nick Nolte in the Bruce Willis part, and Jeff Bridges in the Brad Pitt part.
Right. Who he would then sort of cast, not exactly as the Brad Pitt part, in Tideland, which is...
Which you've seen and I haven't.
Probably Terry Gilliam's worst movie. Worse than The Brothers Grimm, which I can find things to like in The Brothers Grimm.
And the other thing I was thinking today is, and I would like to think among people who know something about movies, that Terry Gilliam has a reputation as a fine director, as a founding member of Monty Python, but like some other directors we can name, it's based on a relatively small body of work.
Yeah.
He is not prolific.
No, but he also, every time he makes a movie, it's at least interesting. And that's rare to have a director who's worked for this long, and even though he hasn't made a ton of movies... I don't think you can really point to any of his movies. I mean, you know, The Brothers Grimm failed because, well, it's not that good for a Terry Gilliam movie, but you can see sort of what he's trying to do, that all of his movies are at least worth seeing and talking about.
And then Parnassus had all the troubles, and he quickly became known as the director who's cursed because the Don Quixote thing went south. And
have you seen Parnassus?
No.
It feels a little bit like someone trying to impersonate Terry Gilliam. Even the title, to me, smacks of, like, sort of this Gilliam-esque whimsy. It's an imaginarium!
But, when you said in the review of Pirates that the visual look of the film, as opposed to the visual sound, I guess, that the visual look of the film owed something to Gilliam, I began to wonder, can you imagine... if Gilliam was allowed to direct something like The Walking Dead, what that would be like. Because his films look like no one else's films.
Except for Tom Hooper's The King's Speech, which I felt owed a lot to Terry Gilliam. The photography of that movie. And it won an Oscar for cinematography.
Seriously?
I really think that, yeah.
In terms of what... where's my brain? The speech therapist.
Jeffrey Rush?
Like Jeffrey Rush's office...
Yeah.
It's not quite realistic. It's very stylized.
Mm-hmm.
So you mean in that sense?
Yeah. I think even some of the lenses he chose to use, I think even rewatching 12 Monkeys today, I thought that The King's Speech owed something to Terry Gilliam. And maybe that's a weird
No, that's very interesting.
To float. I don't know.
Because as I floated before, in all of the podcasts that Patrick and I have done together, there comes a point where he makes a pronouncement that floors me with its intelligence and insight. And I think that was the moment.
It might have been.
Unless you have more up your sleeve.
Oh, please. I barely got that out.
Back to Bruce Willis.
Yes.
My favorite moment in this film, and it floored me the first time I saw it, and I was looking forward to it again and hoping beyond hope that it doesn't suffer with age, when he's in the car with Madeline Stowe, and he says, put music on the radio. There's this long close-up of his face, and Blueberry Hill comes up on the radio. And his face, my God, is that a performance. He starts to cry.
Yeah.
And he says, you don't understand. We don't have music like this in the future. And it's interesting because that's the part that I was really floored by this time. But in my mind, the moment that I carried with me was his head out the window and just that the air is fresh and he just can't get enough of it. It's like a drug to him. That is a magnificent scene.
That is a great scene. You had mentioned the how horrible the we don't have music like this. I think maybe more than almost any other movie, and I'm sure there's a case to be made for, you know, the Road Warrior or whatever. I can't believe every vision of the future in movies is this dystopian vision of the future.
Yes.
I don't know if there's another movie where the future looks as miserable as 12 Monkeys. Again, you've got the Road Warrior where, you know, it's this crazy wasteland of savages trying to kill you and stuff, but there's something that's so oppressively, like, claustrophobic, the fact that they have to be underground, the fact that they're stacked on top of one another in, like, cages, practically.
I interpreted that. Certainly the vision of the future is grim. I'm not mm-hmm. denying that. My supposition has always been that Willis is in prison.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a really shitty place.
Sure.
The prison in the shitty place.
I guess, but you don't see anywhere else, no. really. And I never have gotten the impression that anywhere else looks any better. Well, but yeah, he's obviously a prisoner, I think, because he's sort of forced into service, and I don't see how they could do that.
And there, Gilliam borrows a trope from himself, because one of the things, well, there's a lot to like. I mean, I think Brazil is one of my favorite films of all time. The idea that sometime in the near future, the police will render you incapable of fighting back by putting you in some sort of suit and leading you around on a big hook, that in Brazil, the criminals are put on hooks. Right. And here again, much like a hamster or something, his cage is opened and he's instructed to put on this garment and this big hook comes down. Man, is that disturbing.
12 Monkeys, I think, has a lot of elements from his previous movies. And it's interesting because I think 12 Monkeys, even, you know, among possibly film students, at least film students that I knew, they would always point to that as their favorite Terry Gilliam movie. And I think part of that is because that's the one the most people have seen because Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt are in it. But also it sort of incorporates elements from a lot of his previous movies. I like it a lot, but it's not, I don't think, one of my favorite Terry Gilliam movies.
And by that you mean Brazil?
No, 12 Monkeys.
Oh, okay.
I think Brazil would be.
I think Brazil and 12 Monkeys follow a through line, and I think it's a little bit too easy to say, well, you know, he's an artist, so he has higher concerns. But the through line that I love through a lot of Gilliam films is that technology has sold us a bill of goods, that we are slaves to it, mm-hmm. that none of it works. The awful pipes in Brazil, the fact that everything has been cobbled together out of mm-hmm. spare parts, and it's horrible. And if you look at the apocalypse in 12 Monkeys, of course, it was caused by technology run amok.
Right. I find myself, again, I really like 12 Monkeys, and part of it is I'm just kind of a mark for time travel movies, and that's not just because I love Back to the Future or whatever.
He is fun.
I rewatched Deja Vu with Denzel Washington a couple weeks ago. I kind of like that movie. It's a stupid time travel movie, but I enjoy it. I like stories about time travel. The trick, of course, is that you can't really think about them too much. I think 12 Monkeys tries really hard to be airtight.
Yes.
But no matter what, I mean, you have to raise questions of if Bruce Willis is to some degree successful at the end of the film, why does any of it take place?
Yes, and
that's the paradox of every time travel movie.
And speaking of paradoxes, again, to bring up my lovely wife, Shmoopy, she pointed this out, that for some strange reason, when the movie's about time travel, I find it incapable of suspending disbelief. So I apply this completely arbitrary thing that makes me sound intelligent, where when it comes to physics and things, I'm not intelligent. You can't go back in time and see yourself. It breaks the first law of physics. Matter cannot be created or destroyed. If Patrick Bromley goes back and looks at 8-year-old Patrick Bromley, and 8-year-old Patrick Bromley says, "Who's that?" Then there's two of them there. Back to the Future breaks the rule. Mm-hmm. 12 Monkeys breaks the rule. But one of the things I really like about 12 Monkeys is Bruce Willis has a recurring dream. Mm-hmm. And we discover the dream is something he witnessed as a child that's going to become very, very important at the end. As we go through the film, the dream subtly changes. The most obvious one being, he originally thinks the man with the ponytail is Brad Pitt, it later turns out it's David Morse.
Right.
And speaking of David Morse,
yes,
Patrick can speak to this because Patrick is aces when it comes to every single part, every single actor in America and Yugoslavia has ever played. Has David Morse ever played someone who isn't evil, possessing of knowledge that we don't know, but we know he has?
Yes.
Smirking, yes. Sadistic?
Yes.
What, has he ever been normal?
Yes. The Green Mile. He plays Tom Hanks' best friend, another prison guard.
Who's decent.
Who's decent.
Not the one who fries the guy out of rancor.
Not that guy.
Okay, I'd have to go back and watch that. Because
I would say don't.
Well, I'm not the biggest fan of that film. My experience with David Morse is, of course, in 12 Monkeys. And he did a season on House.
Okay.
Where he was a despicable villain.
Mm-hmm.
And what other sadistic bastard performances am I thinking of? Because you'll admit, he's played more than
his share. Yeah. I mean, he's a bad guy in a lot of things. I know he played like is he in The Rock? He's The Rock. He's in The Rock. He's like Ed Harris's second in charge.
He plays Dwayne Johnson?
Yes. He's in The Long Kiss Goodnight, where you start out thinking he's a good guy, and he ends up being a bastard in that movie. He's the villain in a bunch of movies. And oftentimes starts out, you don't know he's the villain. You think he's a good guy. Disturbia? Did you ever see Disturbia?
No.
Okay.
Because I had already seen...
and the fascinating side note about Disturbia, he's the neighbor. He moves in, and we suspect him of a killer.
Spoilers, he's Perry Mason.
Spoilers for Disturbia, he's the killer.
He's Raymond Burr.
But they discover, Shia LaBeouf, when he gets into David Morse's house, discovers like this crazy rape dungeon under the house with like bodies. The guy's only lived there a matter of weeks. I don't know how he constructed the rape dungeon, but...
Well, when you're a sadistic bastard villain, you look for a house that has that. It's like the house has got to have a home theater, or it's a deal breaker. Look, I've talked to my real estate agent, and I've made it very clear. If the house does not have a rape dungeon and three bathrooms, that's a deal breaker. Speaking of craziness, it's always nice to see Frank Gorshin getting work.
Yeah, right.
And, man, I think this happened to every single one of those people, and I feel so sorry for them. Frank Gorshin shows up in the film, and my wife turns to me and says, "Riddle me this, Batman." Oh my God, it's 40 years later. Yeah, drop it? Can you imagine how Adam West feels? The other thing, you had mentioned that the people that you went to film school with, that this seems to be a favorite among film students, and maybe it's because the Gillian film with the biggest
stars. It's on the list that I've talked about before. Yeah,
that other than the fact that I think this film rewards you for having some things on the ball, and certainly has lots of film references for sort of film junkies, it also seems to me to be the perfect film study movie because it has these clues that we're supposed to pick up, and it's also very self-aware.
Right.
It's one of those films, and I'm still on the fence. I'm not sure if I like this or I don't like it. Every time a character looks at a TV, there's something playing on the TV that has something thematically to do with...
Now, earlier you had said like it doesn't, that something doesn't call attention to itself, or I don't remember, and I was going to disagree with you because of what you just mentioned, where it's just, it's so obvious. I don't know, when Joe Dante does it in The Howling, for some reason it doesn't bother me, but in this, I mean, it's really over the top.
And I have less patience for the film that does that with music, Don't Fear the Reaper, okay, someone's going to get it.
Right.
But in this film, there's a cartoon about a man who's invented a time machine.
Right.
There's the Marx Brothers and Monkey Business. It gets a little thick, but there's a lot of clue-like evidence in the film that sort of doubles back on itself. And I think that's one of the reasons why film people might enjoy it so much. It's very dense.
I would argue, too, that the movie was a success, and it was, not just based on Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, but it's amazing that any Terry Gilliam movie is a box office success, especially one as dark and sort of weird as 12 Monkeys.
And this movie did make a lot of money, although, oddly enough, most of it overseas.
But I would argue that a lot of that was because the ending is something of a twist, and we love a twist ending, no matter what. That if people can come out of it saying, "Hey, I didn't see that coming. I was tricked in a way,"
Or maybe people who are conversationally challenged like the twist ending because it conveniently gives you something to talk about when leaving the theater, which, you know what that reminds me of?
What's that?
Tangent. In Monty Python's Meaning of Life, we're taken to a restaurant where you're handed conversation cards that give you things to talk about because this sort of vanilla suburban couple are incapable of talking to each other. So they're given cards about philosophers. And they try to make a go of it, but finally the gentleman says, "Waiter, this conversation isn't very interesting." So, I mean, a lot of really successful films in the last 20 years have had that twist. I mean, you can count them off.
And The Sixth Sense doesn't exist without the twist, I would say. But that's my own issue with the film.
And Shutter Island and Inception. And you know, or you do if you religiously listen to this podcast, what big fans of Inception we are. I actually saw the end of this film in terms of the woman's presence on the plane, you being able to interpret that two different ways, as the spinning top of 12 Monkeys, if you choose to go that way. Although I think most people accept the given interpretation that what is happening is actually happening, and that's one of the few positive notes in the film. Although, as you pointed out, if they were successful, the film wouldn't be happening, but then you have to go to a deep, dark dungeon of science fiction geeks.
Right.
And start talking about that theory that there's many futures.
Right, which is the cop-out that a lot of time travel movies make, which is fine, but it's like, as soon as we alter, deja vu kind of does it. It's like, well, if we alter one thing, all we do is create a new reality. The old one still exists, but now we're in the new one, and that's how you get around that.
And Lost famously did that in its last season, and I know there's a lot of fans of Lost, and I was a fan of Lost until the last episode, but the minute they started playing alternate realities, I thought, there's no way they're going to be able to spin this one back in.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, reel. I'm actually making.
I saw the real gesture.
Sign of a fishing reel.
Because you're still on Inception.
That you're never going to be able to reel this in.
Here are two issues that I have with 12 Monkeys. And again, I really like the movie, but it's not my favorite Terry Gilliam movie. One, in the middle of the movie, I feel like there's about a 20-minute section where I feel like the movie is just sort of spinning its wheels.
I agree.
It's a lot of him and Madeline Stowe.
Yeah.
And it exists to sort of get us to the airport, but it's not all necessary. And it's just where he beats up the guy in the apartment building and takes out his teeth. I mean, I understand. Every time they would start to do something where I would think, gosh, why is this in the movie? They would sort of give it, they would put Gilliam put something in, or David Peoples put something in to justify its existence. So that whole scene, I think, this doesn't need to be in the movie. And then he pulls out his teeth. And that becomes important later in the movie. The other thing is, as much as I like the sequence and as much as it feels a lot like Terry Gilliam, specifically Time Bandits, which is a movie I really like, when he accidentally ends up in World War I.
Yeah.
Again, it exists so that Madeline Stowe can see the photograph and I see the other guy who claims he was from the future and now I see Bruce Willis in the picture. Okay, so it has a purpose for being in the movie. But my feeling about that is it feels out of place because it's the only time that we don't end up, in 1990 or in 1996. That's sort of where the two realities of the film take place. And for 3 minutes, we take this bizarre turn to World War I France.
Lovingly recreated.
Right.
It reminds me of something from Paths of Glory.
And it feels very much like a Terry Gilliam beat. My feeling is either don't have that in the movie, or have more of that in the movie.
I can see that, although I like the sequence. I think it's much more entertaining than the 20-minute dull spot you're talking about. And there's something about the photograph of the naked Bruce Willis, reaching out to this injured man. I think Gilliam spent a lot of time on that photograph. There's something about that photograph that's very disturbing and very disconcerting, and it goes well beyond a Where's Waldo thing. It speaks to dislocation. And even in the scene that you're talking about that does seem to be overlong, I think that might be my favorite line in the movie, and I still find it really, really funny when the pimp announces to the police that he was attacked by a crack whore and a crazed dentist. Reminds me of Tracy Walters in Something Wild. When he's interviewed later on TV, she had bracelets, the accoutrements of Satan. And it's really tossed off because it's on the TV in the room, right. And it's not right. Overly dwelled upon. But that's a great line.
Yeah.
That's a great line.
Madeline Stowe is fine in the movie. But again, we talked about how much we like Bruce Willis and how sort of entertaining Brad Pitt is. Madeline Stowe, for me, is sort of a weak spot, and it's not entirely her fault. Her character, to me, doesn't entirely make sense. Where she ends up in the last few minutes of the movie doesn't make sense with what I've seen before.
Well, one critic said that their romance didn't seem organic. It seemed to be out of desperation. And not in desperation of a film that wants to have some romance, but that both of them are leading very, very bleak lives.
And I would kind of agree with that.
I think she's given a role that's underwritten, and although she received praise for her performance when mm-hmm. the film came out, I have a problem with her performance too. I think it's a weak spot in the film in that the woman that we're presented with doesn't stay with Bruce Willis as long as she does during the scary part.
Right.
That she's smart and scared and resourceful, and she deals with crazy people every day. And there's an element here of, why are you sticking around?
Right.
Although, like you said, the film really falls over itself to say, she thinks he has a gun. Now she really has a gun. Mm-hmm. Now she's tied to the bed, etc.
And some of the Hitchcock stuff at the end, which I like, I don't know that the movie supports the references. Because I don't think the majority of the film owes very much to Hitchcock. But then at the end, all of a sudden, we're getting these sort of quotes from Vertigo. And aside from Terry Gilliam saying, well, you know, I really like Alfred Hitchcock, or I want to just have these other film references in the movie, I don't necessarily understand what they're doing in the movie.
I think thematically it goes back to, and it speaks to, back from the dead, this feeling that we can go back and erase mistakes that we made, that James Stewart is given this job and fails, and then finds this woman who he's going to turn into this dream woman, that somehow he can go back and erase the mistake. Thematically, I think there's a lot there. But again, any film that quotes Hitchcock and quotes it as explicitly as this film does,
right,
you have to earn it. Right. And it comes across as they're being chased by everyone. They're going to hide out in a movie theater that's showing a Hitchcock festival. That's something only a film guy would make up.
Right.
Well, where else would they end up? Lee Harvey Oswald ended up in a theater.
And it's just so we could get the reveal of Madeline Stowe, who's now a blonde. But again, right. The reason for her transformation has nothing to do with the reason for Kim Novak's transformation in Vertigo. So there isn't a connection there other than, well, they both become blonde.
It comes across as screenwriting rather than...
And it's interesting because I remembered much more of it than is actually in the movie.
Yeah.
When I was thinking back on 12 Monkeys before I watched it, I remembered thinking that theater sequence and all the Hitchcock stuff played a much larger role in 12 Monkeys than it actually does. So maybe that's to its credit. I don't know.
Character actor alert.
Yes.
Watching the film.
Okay.
Near the end.
Yes.
Overly talkative cab driver.
Okay.
And again, leading my wife to say, what kind of cab driver engages her customers? It's Annie Golden.
I recognized her, but I didn't know from what.
Many, many, many years after Hair.
Okay.
Where she played Jeannie.
Okay.
And she was also in one of the only National Lampoon things that went right to video that was actually good. It's like the Second City review that they did live.
Okay.
They later videotaped.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember the name, and it's not coming to me. But again, watching it again, I felt that you couldn't get this film financed today. If you did, it would take a very different form. And that one of the reasons is, I so applaud the fact that this film really doesn't spoon-feed it to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's really expecting you to be a good, engaged theater audience.
Mm-hmm.
And at no point do we get, and you can imagine this in another worse film, Madeline Stowe has an assistant or a fellow professor who at one point engages in a long monologue where things are explained.
Right.
Gilliam gives him a lot of credit, and that's what I like about him. Going back to your previous point, 12 Monkeys is not your favorite Gilliam film,
right,
you said.
Right.
What is?
Brazil. And then possibly Time Bandits, which is not necessarily a popular choice, but I really like that movie.
I would say my favorite Gilliam film is Brazil as well. I mean, Brazil is amazing. And in fact, there's a shot in 12 Monkeys that sort of quotes it. This magnifier that's put in front of the female scientist's face at one point is very much like Catherine Hellman in Brazil. I'd have to say, though, that my second favorite Terry Gilliam film is Munchausen.
Okay.
The, you know, for all the bad press that film got.
Right.
During our recent adventures overseas, I couldn't help but think about the part of Munchausen that suggests that the people in power have a vested interest in keeping us very, very scared. And if we were to just open the gates, we would discover that they're protecting us from nothing, and they're doing it in their own self-interest.
Which, again, is very much a recurring theme of a lot of Terry Gilliam's movies.
And not something that you see in a fantasy film. And
right.
I think the funny stuff in Munchausen is really funny, and I think the
fantastic... Except for the Robin Williams stuff.
Well...
But that's a movie that you need to see five times before you can really take in just what's happening on screen. His movies are so dense, just visually speaking.
And how fully realized the fantasy elements are.
Yeah.
And again, it looks like no other film, and it's really entertaining, and I don't understand why it's got the reputation it has.
Because I think it's not a movie that would appeal to a lot of people, and it was overly expensive, and so you can't spend too much money on a movie that has a limited audience, right? But that's Terry Gilliam's career.
Sometimes I often wonder why, and maybe this is yet another example. Oh, watch out, big tangent coming very soon. Why it's not the new Wizard of Oz.
Mm.
I mean, that's what high esteem I hold it in, and I guess I find it a lot more accessible. But again, this might be another one of JB's Cyrus moments, which leads to my final thoughts.
Okay.
Final thought. At one point, we need to post something on F This Movie.
Okay.
With all of these little things,
like the glossary.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah, we got an email from a listener who is great, Don Hunt, who coined the phrase "the Goonies derivation."
We love you, Don.
Right, and you had come up with the Book of Eli effect. She listed several in an email, so we probably need to start. If you are a listener out there and you've noticed some of these and you have ideas, you know, for what they should be called, or even I've heard you guys talk about this, email them to us.
And I think they're great shorthand for things.
Yeah.
And we're forming this sort of club where this might be useful shorthand. Another one I'm thinking of is the Chris Farley Show.
Right.
Because to a certain extent, this entire podcast has been the Chris Farley Show.
Oh, I don't agree.
So here's my solution. I'm going to go back in time.
Okay.
And figure out why it is that we like this movie so much, and I'm gonna fix it.